Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Svarim Chatter Live. Today, we're going to be joined by Professor Eric Lowy, he's a professor of Bible at Bar-Ilan University in Eretz Yisrael. So that's why we're having a daytime show versus an evening. I know maybe people prefer the evening, but Sunday afternoon, we're going to be discussing mainly Rashi and his recent book on Rashi through Oxford University Press. And that was perfect. Spilled that water. Which is Rashi's commentary on the Torah. Sorry. Canonization and resistance in the reception of a Jewish classic. So that is mainly what we will be discussing once you get a moment. Hold on. Sorry. You're on, but you're not on the audio. So click to join. There we go. Hold on a moment. Let me get you on. There we go. Okay, you're on now. We do have contact. Okay. Thank you very much for joining.
I'm Ira Kodesh.
Oh, wow. All the way. Yeah. So I guess start off, tell us a bit about your background and about yourself.
I guess maybe I'll start from the present and discuss all the fascinating details from the past. I teach at Bar-Ilan University in Ramat Gan. We moved to Israel in 2012 from Toronto. I was teaching at a university there. My academic training started out in Toronto, at least in terms of my BA. I did my doctorate at Harvard and then taught for a while at Stanford in Palo Alto, California.
Oh, wow.
But we decided the weather was, too boring in Palo Alto, and why not spend more time in a winter in Toronto? So Al Rego Achad. I came to Jewish learning pretty late in life, actually. Well, I have sons who are Talmidei Chachamim and maybe daughters who are budding Talmidot Chachamim. I can't put myself in that class.
Mm-hmm. And where did you, so you said you went to Harvard. That was where you got your doctorate, right?
Correct.
And that was under Professor Isidore Twersky or Rabbi Dr. Yitzchok Twersky, everyone to refer to him, who... the listeners will know we had on already Mark Shapiro and Rabbi Jacob J. Schachter, both also Talmidim. They spoke about him a bit. Maybe you want to talk about also your time there at Harvard and studying under him.
It was a special time. It was a privilege. Professor, as you say, he was either the Talmud Rebbe on one side of the Charles River or Dr. Isidore Twersky on the other side of the river. But I guess, one of the questions that that people close to him often spent maybe too much time thinking about was how those two parts of his intellectual and religious personality went together. He was in my mind something of a heroic figure, I would say, and but also an enigmatic figure. It was always a little perplexing to try to infer exactly how he put all the different parts of him together. He came from this Hasidic background. Of course, he was the son-in-law of the Rav. He got to Boston Latin School, and here he was, a Harvard professor. But the result was a unique voice, one that was sadly cut down before its time. And he was, a great doctor father, that is to say, someone who trained me in academic Jewish studies, but I also became close to him personally. He was a sandek for our second son and used to go to Shalashudis at the Tolner Beis Medrash. So, my connection to him by the end was very, very multi-dimensional.
Right. Recently, they published a book, a sefer of his Torah on Bereshis and Shemayis. Is that from that those Shalashudis Shmuzin that he gave there?
Right. So it's a bit tamsiti, but it does give you a taste of, I would say, some of the idiosyncratic is perhaps not quite the right word, but the as I say, the unique voice that he had. It was put out by one of really his Talmud Muvhak, who took notes over many decades, both from Shaul Shudis and from the Divrei Torah he used to give on other occasions, David Shapiro. And I definitely commend it, but only with a slight caveat that it's, difficult to capture in writing some of the nuances. One thing I think that does come through is the unbelievable breadth of his complete mastery of the tradition from beginning to end, and the way he put together very different sources, some from his own heritage. I remember once on some Shabbos shows he began, two grandfathers, and it was, the Brisker dynasty on one side and it was the Schnober dynasty on the other side. And he felt equally at home and equally loyal to those different traditions, but also to many other voices that wouldn't typically be aired at an average Shalashuddha. So it was always a treat to hear what he had to say. Nothing was ever canned about it. It was always fresh and something that had a sort of spiritual dimension that I think only his unique personality was able to produce.
Wow. And then last week, Zalman Shazar, the institute, published a new brand new book edited by Professor Karmi Horowitz of his a collection of all his, it looks like, I guess I'm asking you what it is exactly. It's a collection of all his articles. Were they originally written in Hebrew? Are they translated? What exactly is that I assume you know about it.
Right. So the aim, Kamayan Hamid Gaber, I'm sad to say that we were supposed to actually have a conference tomorrow here in Yerushalayim, and there was supposed to be a parallel conference at YU devoted to the occasion. Of course, due to circumstances, both of those had to be postponed. I'm using the word postponed optimistically, and I assume that will be true, that these will eventually happen. The idea was to gather together articles that had been, far flung in different, sometimes obscure journals. But as you suggested, the main idea was really to make the English articles accessible to a Hebrew reading audience. Anyone who's ever read an article by Professor Tversky in English knows that his English was not of the standard, teenage variety, but it was an extremely sophisticated, nuanced, and sometimes quite demanding English. And so the great challenge was to try to render that to some degree in Hebrew. I think we did accomplish that. I was, had a very tiny hand in it. Karmi Horowitz gets all the credit for the project from beginning to end, and invested tremendous efforts in trying to make sure that his Rebbe got to be more familiar to an Israeli audience. And I think he's certainly right that Professor Tversky never quite had the impact in Eretz Yisrael that he could have had he not written more in Hebrew. He actually wrote a beautiful Hebrew, a very stylized rabbinic Hebrew, itself challenging. And those articles, certainly are digested by Israeli scholars, but the idea is now to make the full corpus available and also to sort of categorize it and give it some sort of shape in terms of the larger themes that guided his interests. Of course, his focus on the Rambam, which was paramount, his focus on Jewish spirituality, and his vision of sort of the DNA, I guess you could say, of Judaism from his point of view, which turned on concepts which he developed of Jewish halachocentricity. Halacha was always the core in his understanding of things, but also what he called meta halacha, the idea that there was constant efforts to supplement halacha by various disciplines, philosophy, Kabbalah, Parshanut HaMikra, and to make sure that halakha did not become too frozen, stale, or routinized, the word that he used frequently and was, I would say, practically the biggest swear word in his spiritual vocabulary. The worst thing for him was when halakha became routinized and one lost a sense of its overriding objectives and its spiritual outcomes.
Do you know if are all the articles just translations from English, or were there any that were written in Hebrew at all in the book?
Now, I think Hebrew articles also appear, the ones that were originally, and I think there are some, and I actually haven't had a chance to handle. I think it Mamash came out a few days ago, But some of the original Hebrew articles are there, but they're now wedded with the English articles.
Right, gotcha. Okay, so when you were studying under him at Harvard, you wrote your dissertation on the Abarbanel, right?
That is correct.
Okay, so what drew you to the Abarbanel to write a dissertation and to study the Abarbanel?
There were a lot of things. In the end, a book came out of it, which I called His Stance Toward Tradition. And that's what the focus, I mean, on some level, it's, almost pashut. It's so fetching and riveting, just his biography. Here you have we would call him a Rishon, who wrote Perushim on Tanakh, on Mor Nevuchim, on Pirkei Avot, wrote on Ikarei Emunah, and on and on. But he was doing this while serving nobles and kings in three different countries, no less. Forced to flee Portugal, where he was born, to evade arrest because of his ties with a powerful noble family. He describes in detail how he had to cross the border after fleeing for 3 days in Portugal. Of course, a victim of the great expulsion of the greatest Jewish community of his day in Europe, the Spanish Jewish community. Just any number of, I won't call them sidelights because they were not highlights, but poignant stories. They attempted to kidnap his grandson to keep him and his son in Spain, and then he eventually ends up in Italy. There too, he ends up fleeing with the King of Naples. He may have gone to Sicily, where there was, at the time in 1493, not a single Jew, and he ends his life in Venice and still has his hand in politics. We actually have a document from the Venetian Senate thanking him for his efforts to resolve a dispute between Venice and Portugal that arose as a result of the circumnavigation of Africa and the ability of the Portuguese to bring spices from India without having to go through Venice. This is not your average biography of somebody who is immersed in the world of higher Jewish learning, and yet, of course, he certainly was that in a certain way, in tremendous diversity of fields. With the one exception, it has to be said of Halakha and Talmud. We don't know that he was especially focused on those areas. We don't really have any record of his achievements in those areas. But otherwise, the diversity of his interests was very broad. So that drew me to him. There was the whole issue of him as a communal leader. The person who had written a dissertation before me, about 50 years before me on Abarbanel, had the last name Netanyahu. Not Bibi, of course, but his father, Ben Sion, was a great historian of Spanish Jewry. And there was a serious question about the quality of Abarbanel's leadership. Ben Sion Netanyahu was quite critical of his failure to foresee the disaster that eventually befell Spanish Jewry. Let's remember that he was writing his dissertation in the early 1950s after having been active as a revisionist in Washington trying to save European Jewry. So the shadow of the Holocaust hung heavy over him as he thought about Jewish leadership, its ups, its downs. And so that was something that was interesting to me, the whole issue of politics that plays a role in Abarbanel. But the main thing I focused on were these issues of what I call the stance towards tradition, which is how he related to different layers of Jewish tradition, especially Chazal, but also the Rambam and earlier Parshanim. What I basically say in the title of the book, Defense, Dissent, and Dialogue, is that he didn't relate in any homogeneous way or uniform way, but there was a lot of complexity there. There was a lot of even ambivalence, perhaps even contradictory tendencies. And so it was an effort to sort out how he sometimes could be very bold and independent in his attitude towards earlier layers of tradition. Other times, he seemed to be not only highly conservative, but even critical of those who deviated from tradition. We have an interesting account of Rav Yosef Yaivitz in his Sefer Or HaChaim, where he talks about someone who gave shiurim on the Mor Nevuchim in Lisbon. And he doesn't say that it's Abarbanel by name, but it's certain that it is Abarbanel. And he talks about how sometimes Abarbanel would end a shiur by saying that this is what Rabbeinu Moshe taught, but it's not what Moshe Rabbeinu taught. So you have this real tension between his admiration for the Rambam on the one hand, but serious criticism of some of the fundamentals of Maimonidean thought on the other hand. So the question was, could you make sense of all this, or was this sort of just a hodgepodge? And many scholars had sort of said there's no real core Abarbanel, and I tried to argue that there is a core Abarbanel, but it is elusive. And It is nuanced and sometimes highly ambivalent. So that was that was sort of the larger theme that drew me, the whole question of tradition, change, independence, when can you be critical, when do you have to defer? Those sorts of issues were the larger issues that were the integrating perspective of the study.
Right, and is that an aspect that your book really differs from Netanyahu's classic biography of him?
I mean, one thing was the focus on his pay regime. I mean, Netanyahu somehow managed to ignore the fact that the main medium that Abarbanel uses to express himself is pay regime on Tanakh, or on other things. And so, that was something I wanted to call to people's attention. And also that sometimes because pay regime or pay regime, you don't always get a thinker's view unmediated. When Rav Sadia Gaon writes Emunot V'Dayot, so you figure the voice you're hearing is Rav Sadia Gaon, who's telling you what he thinks about Briyat HaOlam or Hashgacha or Nevuah or Tchiyat HaMetim. When someone's writing a commentary, there's a sort of a complex dynamic sometimes about exactly how much you're hearing their voice, how much you're hearing them try to explicate what they think the true meaning of a text might be, even if they disagree with it. We have this writ large in Abarbanel's Perush on Mor Nevuchim, where at a certain point when he's talking about the Rambam's Shita in Nevuah, he sort of says, I can't hold back anymore. I know my job is just to explain the Rambam here. That's my hat at the moment. But the Rambam is so wrong-headed on Nevuah being a natural phenomenon that I have to step in and abandon my guise of being just a parshan and tell you that tell you what the truth is, which is that Nevuah is not natural and it's not like the Rambam says, and it's a kav tohu v'avnei vohu, everything the Rambam's telling you. But usually he feels compelled to say, my job now is to explain the Rambam. You want to hear what I have to say, I'll write it down somewhere else. So there's interesting dynamics about the medium of Peirush, which I think Netanyahu doesn't even get to because he doesn't really focus on Barbanel as a Parshan.
I'm curious how much of plays into that whole Rambam thing plays into that the Rambam was very much into Aristotle, while Abarbanel and his son, more famously, was very more into Platonic philosophy, right? Did that play a role there?
Yes, that was part of it, although I'm not sure how much the Platonism exists prior to Italy. I mean, Abarbanel, it's a peculiar intellectual biography in some level. Most of his life was spent in Portugal. We tend to think of him as Spanish, but he was only there for 9 years, having fled Portugal, and then the Tzav HaGeirush forced them to make a choice about what to do, and they, of course, chose to leave. But most of his writings were produced in the last 15 years of his life, between 1492 and 1508. So he picks up a lot of things in Italy, which is, after all, the beginnings of the Renaissance. There's a lot of different currents about in Italy, and he also meets within the Jewish world new trends that he had not encountered before. I like to tell people, Barbanel gets to Italy and he sees something he's never seen before. Ashkenazim, this is like a chiddush, right? For him, and he has certain things to say about that encounter, not always approving. But so the Platonism, I think, is expressed more, at least in the Italian writings. But in general, you're right that some of the opposition that we sometimes think about to philosophy in the Jewish Middle Ages was not to philosophy per se, was not to sechel per se, was not to rationalism per se. It was to this sort of hardcore Aristotelianism, which seemed to be so uncompromising and yielded outcomes like kadmut ha'olam, et cetera. Sometimes that's where people drew the line, even when they were open to other streams of philosophy that seemed more congenial to Jewish tradition and what they viewed as Torah teachings.
Wow. So I have to ask you, it seems to be in the Yeshivish world, he's known as Abarbanel. But in the academic world, it's Abravanel, and that's how Netanyahu's book has it as. Now, your book has it as Abarbanel. So what's the right way, and why do you have it one way, even though most of the academic world has it as Abravanel?
Right. So, I guess I could claim my yeshiva allegiances, but since I never really went to yeshiva, that wouldn't wash as a serious explanation. Now, the truth is, if you look at, I looked at a lot of Portuguese archival documents. Abarbanel was a very important person in Portugal, much more even than in Spain, though he sort of talked about as someone close to Ferdinand and Isabella. That's somewhat true, but he was very close to Afonso II, who was the king of Spain for many decades. And there are many archival records which discuss Abarbanel, Portuguese origin. And if you look at the records, you find all sorts of different pronunciations. You have to realize people are not as muck-peed on how you say your name in the 15th century. So you have Abravanel there, you do have Abarbanel, you have Ravanella. Somehow, and I don't know how this was decided, maybe it just sounded more Sephardic and cultured, Gretz and Baer and other people, earlier scholars of Abarbanel, wrote Abravanel. And I read an article early on by Schneer Wyman. It was published in 1968. And he gives some evidence, even independent of the point I'll mention now, that it was probably said Abarbanel by the Abarbanels. But the main thing that he mentions there is we have the Sefer HaTishbi of Eliyahu Bachur, Elijah Levita. And it was published in 1541, I think. But he's a younger contemporary of Abarbanel. He taught in Padua for a number of years, which overlap with the end of Abarbanel's life in Venice. That is, they're not very far from one another. In fact, Abarbanel was buried in Padua because there was an Isur against Jewish burial in Venice. And Abarbanel was at the peak of his fame then. And in this book, which is actually pointed, is vocalized on two occasions. Eliyahu Bachur points at Abarbanel, I think one with a tzeiri, one with a segel, but basically points at Abarbanel. So Schneer Wyman says, lichora, if you had to choose between the two, it would be reasonable to say that this particular person, who even if he never met the Abarbanels, probably heard about the Abarbanels and made a point of pointing his name not once but twice in a sefer that way, it's reasonable to think that that might be the closest thing. But there's no final way to decide. I can give you as a modern footnote, there's a I assume he is still with us. There was a lawyer in Portland, Oregon, named Alan Abarbanel, who ran the Abarbanel family newsletter. I don't know if it still exists, but for a long time, there's like hundreds of Abarbanels in the world. And I once asked him, so what? So you can be the posek over here and tell me, is it Abarbanel or is it Abarbanel? He told me 50% of us say Abarbanel, 50% of us say Abarbanel. So apparently it's machloket l'shem shemayim, and it's sofo lehit
Interesting. Yeah, overall, he's Abarbanel. It's like that's how they call his Sfarim and when they read it. So I wanted to get on that also. Recently, there's been like a real renaissance in his works because Chorev Publishing House redid all the stuff on Torah and Nach. And then there's
Right.
someone, Oren Golan, he's publishing published a bunch of volumes, the Yeshuas Mashiach, and a couple of the Mashiach trilogy, and on
Right.
Avos. And also, there's another new edition published on that also by Yitzchok Ben Zvi, no, Yad Rav Nissim, sorry. And then there's some stuff in English. I mean, it's like I've been a explosion recently. But just mainly, would you? Is there one safer place to pick up? You could start learning and say that would, you could see that Abarbanel has thought from that, or no? There's no real way.
I think it's hard to pick one, although I wrote a chapter in my book on Atirdz Keinim, which was his very first work. It's a very short work. It focuses on the drama of the little-known Atzilei B'nai Yisrael. If you remember at the end of Parshat Mishpatim there, you have a few psukim which talk about the Atzilei B'nai Yisrael, and the Rambam has a negative view of them. So too does Rashi, right? Lo shalach yado, it says the Kodesh Baruch Hu didn't send forth his hand. Mikan shayu, ru'uyim lahashlachat yad, Rashi says. So Abarbanel sets out in the sefer to redeem the besmirched reputation of the Atzilei ben Israel. And then he talks about the larger parsha, which has a lot of interesting things in it. That sefer, in many ways, is a certain microcosm of many of the themes that were important to me. I actually wrote this in Portugal. It was his first finished work. And it has a lot of the themes and also some of the attitudes in terms of predecessors, the centrality of the Rambam, the attitude towards Chazal, which is respectful but highly independent in this case, and so on and so forth. That's not a bad place to, if you wanted to read short Abarbanel. Now, short Abarbanel is in small supply, as you know. So, from the point of view of trying to get some, quick sense of his vision, that would be one possibility. But after that, you have so many different works which have so many different foci, and sometimes they have their own agenda, which doesn't always even, I would say, shtim, to use a good Sephardic word, with all the other passages or Sfarim that Abarbanel wrote. Some themes are pretty consistent. You know, the preoccupation with the Rambam is there from beginning to end. He wrote a letter late in life where he talks to, he says, and how I spent too much time reading philosophic works. I should have stuck with Tanakh and the Rambam, who explains all the drushim, all the sort of great themes that you need to understand. He says, not that I agree with everything he says. Says a tov nikabel, va'ra'lo nikabel. But so there are certain things which would stay consistent, but there's a lot of evolution there, which makes sense in part because of the upheavals of his life. Not that I want to pin all of his ideas on what's happening around him, but there is a certain logic to saying that someone who witnesses some of the personal trials and tribulations he suffered, and then the, you know, catastrophe of Geirut Sfarad, you know, is not going to be untouched by that, and is going to A, feel compelled to address certain issues like hashgacha for himself, and B, certainly address those issues because he has now a readership that is looking, searching for answers. I don't know if you have ever come across this passage. It's just one of the most remarkable passages probably in Hebrew literature, which I don't know if I have a right to say such a thing, but I'll say it anyway. In his Perush on the Haggadah, where he's interpreting the Mizmor Tehillim, there he says, Kol ha'adam kozev. So it's a complicated bit of parshanut there with a lot of nuances, but he basically says kol is like a ribui, right? So we know everyone, you know, people, normal people lie, but what's the kol over here? So he says basically, and you can see he's echoing the sentiments of many people who have come to Yeyush after the Geirush. He says kol ha'adam kozev, talking about Moshe Rabbeinu, all the Nevi'im, talking about Yeshayahu with all his promises of comfort. Kol ha'adam kozev, even the Nevi'im lie to us. Now he's careful to couch this in terms of people who have now been liberated. We're now sitting at our Seder. It's Yimei HaGeulah, Yimot HaMashiach, and we're looking back and saying, oh, that's what we said mistakenly. But in the meantime, you see that he's giving voice to what I assume are, you know, the voices he was hearing. You can call it, if you want, post-Holocaust theology. People asking serious questions. So it stands to reason that, you know, he was forced to address those things. The whole Mashiachiyut focus is one that is post-1492. Some people have treated it as if that's sort of all he talks about. After 1492, I tried to argue in an article that that's actually the exception rather than the rule. But he does have very detailed messianic promises there, including dates. And, you know, that is something I don't think one would have expected had he stayed in tranquil Portugal for all of his life, but he wasn't a zocheh to that. So, although I often point out, absent his having to flee Portugal and Spain, we probably wouldn't be sitting here talking about Abarbanel, because he probably would have been busy with the stocks and less busy with the you know,
Right, I was going to mention that one of the first Ram that I went through was the Haggadah Zevach Pesach, which a beautiful new edition from Mosar Hav Kook, and he laments in his whole introduction about all the Gerushim, and then he really comes through the whole time how he's trying to talk about the Haggadah of being freed, and he's obviously talking to everybody like post-Holocaust, like you said, where they went through all these Gerushim and they don't feel free. I think you really see it in there in the Pirush in the Haggadah.
Right, no, it's very pained, very pained. You know, what do we have to celebrate Yetziat Mitzrayim? We're sitting here in exile and trying to understand our sorry fate. And you know, those are parts of Abarbanel that I think spoke to me in the sense of they had a real existential dimension to them beyond all of the brilliance and often the creative ideas. There was the raw encounter with historical ups and downs, such as Jews have often suffered, and such as Barbanel knew B'Shefa, both, as I say, personally and from the communal experience, trauma that he had undergone as part of the Gerush.
Right, so
He had a grandson, by the way, you know, who I mentioned this attempt to kidnap his grandson in Spain to keep him there. That grandson ended up in Portugal. That's where he was sent because there was still Abarbanels in Portugal. And in 1492, that looked like a good move. In 1497, when all of Portuguese Jewry was forcibly converted to Christianity, that was a heartbreaking move, and one which Abarbanel's oldest son, who was the father of this boy, had many recriminations about. We have a very moving poem, Tlunah Lazman, where he talks about how it wrecked his marriage and the guilt that he felt for sending his son there. Not that he could have known, obviously, but So these are things that, needless to say, must have left his mark on Abarba. Now he doesn't necessarily talk about each and every one of these incidents, but we know them from other places, and you can, fill out the picture of his biography by making certain assumptions about how he would have reacted to some of these very challenging events.
Right. Well, so this was in your dissertation, and it became, like I said, in your book. So that I'll post the link to this after. I think I found it used. I mean, it's pretty readily available. It's pretty affordable, this book. So I'll post about it. Now onto the next part, I guess we should say, is recently, I believe a year ago, you published a new book on Rashi. So and about canonization and resistance. I guess I'll let you talk about that. How did you get from Abarbanel and you went to Rashi, a bit different, and talk about your research on him as well?
How I get to Rashi, I have to think about that a little bit, but I think it was through something which does link to the Abarbanel book. I mentioned I focused a lot on his attitude toward Chazal. He wrote one of his messianic works is Yeshuot Mashiach, which is on the Agadot Chazal having to do with Mashiach. So I was always very interested in responses to Midrash. I teach a course on that at Bar Ilan, attitudes towards Midrash over the ages. And of course, the great spokesperson for Midrashic interpretation of Tanakh and especially the Torah in the Jewish Middle Ages, needless to say, is Rashi. So I was interested in certain critics of Rashi. Initially, the book was going to focus a little more on the critical approach to Rashi that was attested in, admittedly, some very obscure and still obscure writers, hopefully slightly less obscure now that my book is out, but nonetheless, or maybe even some would say deservedly obscure, or maybe hashgachically obscure, I don't know. Anyway, but then I, sort of started to realize there's a whole other side to that story, and that is I got very interested in Peirushim on Peirush Rashi, and then I started to ask, well, how did Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki become Rashi? I mean, what is it that makes this person, 900 years after he ceased putting pen to paper, the Parshan, of course, not only of the Torah, but of the Bavli. I didn't tackle both of those. That would have been way too large a project, and I'm not especially suited to the second part of that question. But that was the sort of question that loomed larger and larger, and it fit in with this theme of tradition that was so central in my Abarbanel book. So that was sort of what launched the project, and then I discovered there was just a boundless amount of material, not just in the sort of narrow sense of Parshanim who respond to Rashi, which goes without saying, Ibn Ezra and Ramban, and on the list goes. But other ways in which Rashi left his mark in Jewish education, different images of Rashi written Baruch HaKodesh, all sorts of dimensions to the project, and I sort of decided to tackle the first 500 years essentially. I decided Mizrahi was a good place to stop as the person who became the commentator on the commentator. Now there's a whole other book to be written, but I don't think I'm going to write it on, from Mizrahi to ended my book. I have an afterword, ended my book with David Ben Gurion. So if you want the from Mizrahi to Ben Gurion is open and you can take it.
So what's the best place to get a biography on Rashi, so to speak? Your book is not exactly tackling that. Is there, I mean, what I guess also what are the best books on Rashi? Obviously, Avraham Grossman's classic, I assume, is where it starts. What would you say?
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot written on Rashi, although we don't know a ton about his biography. I mean, Abarbanel, the problem is we know much too much, as it were, because then you have to decide what to include. But with Rashi, we know sort of bare outlines. He's born in France, from Penn. He goes to study, of course, in the great yeshivot in Germany, in Mainz, and later in Worms. He comes back to France, which was not, I don't think, Mubon Me'alav. I'm not expert in this, but the fact that he did that proved to be decisive because he makes France then the center of Ashkenazic learning with all that that implies for the next stage of Baalei HaTosafot. Even Grossman, who certainly is the master of all things Rashi, can't tell us endless amounts about Rashi. You can try and tease out aspects of his personality and commitments, But again, that gets us back to sort of the fact that he chose commentary as his main vehicle of expression. It's a little hard sometimes to get behind those commentaries to the commentator. And also, he was a huge anav. Grossman argues that he was not a shrinking violet, and he knew how to serve his community as a decisive leader. Undoubtedly, that's true. But there is something, very winning about Rashi's reticence about putting himself forward as the main focus of attention. So there is the biography of Grossman that was published in Hebrew in the Zalman Shazar Gedolei HaRuach series, and then I can't remember, a few years ago, maybe 5 years now or something, was published in an English translation, not perfectly adapted for all American audiences because it assumes certain things that you might not know. But I think most of the people listening to any of your shows would have no trouble with that. Certainly a great place to start is Grossman's study.
Right, which is what I assume. So another one thing that he touches on there, and you bring up in your book, and I've been asked this regarding to this interview, people wanted to ask you, is how much of Rashi on Chumash is Rashi? And I know he gives a number, but I'll let you talk about that.
Right. I mean, I have to say, in my book, I had to decide how much to get into this topic because once you get in, you effectively never get out. It's a fascinating area. It's, of course, a crucial area. You want to know what Rashi really wrote, quote unquote. We'll get maybe to that question in a second, but that's not a simple question to answer. Maybe not even the right way to frame the question. But just to get to some of the sort of bottom line, Grossman talks about 90% of the standard edition that we have nowadays, which is essentially a product of the second Mikra Gedolot, or Mikra Gedolah, if you want to be a little more technical, published by Daniel Bomberg in 1524, 1525, that 90% of that is what left Rashi's pen. Now, not everyone agreed with him. His Bar Pluta in this was Elazar Tewitu, former member of my department at Bar-Ilan, who becomes a methodological question. How do you decide these issues? And Tewitu basically said that you can only be certain that a comment was original to Rashi if it appears in all the good manuscripts of the Torah commentary. He claimed that no medieval scribe or copyist would ever have knowingly omitted any of Rashi's comments. At any rate, the upshot was that he was more skeptical and came up with figures that were much lower than that. I think I wrote you when we first started chatting about this that I have it only on Das Torah, Professor Grossman, that it's 90%. Basically, my attitude was my book is focused on reception of Rashi, and hence what people got as their Rashi is what I was interested in. And to the extent they responded to that, that was their response to Rashi, and that did save me a lot of textual work, because otherwise you're talking about hundreds of manuscripts and a certain amount of patience to work through these issues comment by comment. The main point to grasp, probably, well, two. One is that we know from a particular manuscript that Grossman favors very strongly as the best manuscript, and other scholars now, including another colleague of mine, Yitzchak Penkower, I think, has shown very decisively this to be the case, the Leipzig Manuscript 1. We know that Rashi himself introduced changes into his commentary over time. We know that his Beit Midrash in general was very open. He took questions from students. It was a small Beit Midrash. And, part of his gadlut was that, A, he rethought things. All Gedolei Torah, I assume, do that. And also that he was open to criticism from his Talmidim. So this manuscript, Leipzig Manuscript 1, has records of the changes that Rashi himself made, some 80 or so, records of changes made by his Talmid Muvhak, Shmaria. And it was made by a copyist who had as his model, that's what he tells us at any rate, who had as his model the version of Peirush Rashi that Shemariah used. And one of the great virtues of the manuscript is it identifies comment by comment. This is what Rashi added. This is what I, Shemariah, have added, based sometimes on what I heard from Rashi. And sometimes this scribe, his name is Mechir ben Karshavia, we think that's how he said his name anyway, sometimes added comments of his own, but identified them as such. It's available, by the way, online for people who want to see it, both in a readable Hebrew, but also you can look at PDFs of the actual manuscript from Leipzig, at, I'll put in a plug for my friend Novetsky, alhatorah.com. One of the great virtues among many of that particular website is that you can actually see Leipzig Manuscript 1, and sometimes in the notes there he brings other good readings from other reliable manuscripts.
So the question just that someone asked you, I don't know, maybe you know, probably, where is this 90% number exactly come from? And also, are there certain things that we know that Rashi did not write? For example, that some of it, certain expressions, certain, I guess, Rashis that are not his.
Right. There are certain ones that you can certainly identify as not his. One place to find these is in the new Haketer edition, which is, again, I'm putting in plugs for my home institution here, but it's a wonderful edition, as I'm sure you know. Haketer did something which, from the point of view of, pre-academic scholarship, you could quibble about, I suppose, but from the point of view of your question, is a wonderful, wonderful resource, and that is that they, if a Rashi was famous enough as Rashi, they kept it, but if they were pretty sure that it wasn't authentic, they put it in square brackets. And so, that being the case, you can see what they surmised to be the inauthentic ones. The only serious lacuna one has to identify with the Getter, which may unfortunately never be remedied, is that we don't really know how they made those decisions. They base themselves primarily on one Parma manuscript, but they also use Leipzig and other manuscripts. And they were supposed to put up all the variant readings on a website. I'm not sure, unfortunately, that that's going to happen for various reasons. But that's a good place to see. And I think one thing that you begin to appreciate, I mentioned this in the book, is that it's not hard to add Davar Acher to Rashi, right? In other words, the way Rashi writes lends itself to this sort of additions. And when I say additions, it's not some malicious attempt by someone necessarily to sneak in some idea of their own. It has to do a lot with especially scribal culture in Ashkenaz, where people would write marginal notes, and then the next Ma'atik or Sofer comes along. Sometimes he understands what he's writing more, sometimes he understands what he's citing less. He might be making for himself, might be himself a Talmid Chacham, he might just be someone getting paid to do the job. And he incorporates some side note. He doesn't know. Maybe that was something Rashi wrote, but it didn't make it into the last version. So I'll put it back in. And slowly over time, you have these accretions. But to give one case that was discussed again by a Bar-Ilan colleague, Hanan Olmach, one of the comments of Rashi that I think many people could recite. When they have the fraught meeting between Yaakov and Esav after many years of separation, and he sort of says, among other things, his calling card is Im lavan harasha garti v'taryag mitzvot shamarti v'lo lamadati mima'aseh ra'im. So that is a midrash, and you find it cited in various places. I don't remember all the instances that Chanan Olmach brings. I think it certainly was cited by Moshe Darshan. It may have predated him. It makes its way to Spain, and the Rashba mentions it. But all the people who cite this Midrash, and know this Midrash, fail to mention, oh, I saw this in Peirush Rashi. And if you look even as late as all the first printings, so that's already, 1469, 70 on, I think it's only in the Lisbon printing that it appears. That is to say, only one out of nine of the pre-1500 editions. When no one mentions this as a none of the Bali Tosafot Ola Torah and all these other places where you might expect them to say, oh, Rashi said so, and then it does appear in the Mikra Gedolot, and then from thence on, I assume many drashot and shuls and many Divrei Torah around the Shabbat tables were given on this Rashi that Rashi said in Lavangardi. Well, there it's very hard to argue that that left Rashi's pen when we have 400 years of texts that even quote it without mentioning Rashi, and no one quotes it in his name. So those are cases where you can say with a high degree of certainty, and these are pretty much in that case absolute certainty, that that was not an authentic part of Rashi's interpretation of that particular pasuk.
Right. Okay. So the book that you published, it came out through Oxford University Press, which I'll link to it after. And as well, I think you sent me, there still is a code that works for 30% off because it is a bit pricey. So I can put that up for people if they would like to purchase it. It's a fantastic book. And mainly the book focuses on, like you said, a lot of canonization as Rashi, how Rashi came to be I guess, the universal commentator. So I guess we should start talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, one reason to use words like canonization is it's a fancy academic term and impresses your friends and family. But I also thought it was, a very apt term for what happens to Rashi, although I also felt compelled to define that term because people sometimes will speak about texts as canonical in Judaism, and we don't have a pope who waves a magic wand and says, okay, this is the Perush. No one ever said, Rashi and nothing else. If they had said that, Ramban presumably never could have written the Perush al Torah. So, what does it mean to say that Rashi is a canonical text? I would say one distinction that I found helpful is drawn by Moshe Halbertal, is that he speaks about texts which are part of a normative canon and part of a formative canon. When we say the Shulchan Aruch is canonical, what we mean is you're supposed to follow the Shulchan Aruch, you're supposed to listen to the Shulchan Aruch, you're supposed to obey the Shulchan Aruch, right? That's a normative canon. When it comes to Perush Rashi LaTorah, it's not you're supposed to, follow Rashi LaTorah or obey Rashi LaTorah. So what does it mean to speak of a formative canon? It means this is what people teach. This is what they teach in Gan, and this is what they taught in, the Yeshivot of Ashkenaz, the Gedolei Ashkenaz wrote Perushim on the Maharal and the Levush and others. This is what people read. They read it in shul. They read it on Shabbat. They use it as a source for drashot and so forth. This is the text that got transmitted. It got transmitted practically more than any other text in the Jewish Middle Ages. There are over 200 manuscripts of Perush Rashi, some 180 preserved full versions of Rashi. I mean, just to give you a comparison, I have some statistics in the first chapter of the book. I don't remember all of them, but something like Sefer Kuzari. We have like dozens of manuscripts, which is very mechubad for a medieval sefer, but it's not hundreds of manuscripts. I think Ibn Ezra comes down in 100 manuscripts, which is a lot. Ramban is 50 plus manuscripts. Famously, Rashbam came down in a single manuscript, and since then we've lost even the single manuscript. So that's not the end all and be all of deciding what's canonical. Like the Smak, for example, was produced a lot. It was, a popular sefer. It doesn't necessarily mean it became the sefer, but it is something of a rough barometer of not only popularity, but what I call canonicity in the sense of something that was providing Jews in everywhere with a sort of shared vocabulary. It makes its way to Tayman, it makes its way to Spain, and it makes its way to Italy. And I mean, this is not Mouvan Me'alav. And if it lasted for 300 years, if my book lasts for 300 weeks, I'll be happy. But Rashi is still going strong. People are still writing Perushim on Rashi. They write them in English. They write them in French. They write them in Hebrew. It's just an achievement which I don't know of all world literature, but I can't imagine there are too many texts in any tradition that make this sort of claim on a tradition over centuries. That really is something that requires explanation. How does it do it, and what is its appeal? So that was sort of the point of departure for the part about canonicity. And then I did speak a certain amount, although this is remains to be studied, another book in the making, about his role in education. That I think is very fundamental. The fact that Rashi speaks to different ages, from the youngest to the oldest, from the dilettante to the greatest scholars, and in certain cases was understood to be the only text that you could teach if you were going to teach a commentary on the Torah. But we have, by the way, talking about canonicity in the Maimonidean controversies, right? The famous controversies that break out, or really rationalism controversies is more precise, in the 1230s. Two Southern French Maimonideans complain that essentially the Northern French scholars, the Balei HaTosafot, we would call them, have issued a gezeirah. That's a gezeiratchem is the word I think he uses, one of them, saying that the only commentator you can use to understand Torah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim, and Gemara is Perush Rashi. And he basically, writes there, if you want to make Rashi canonical for you, b'vakasha. But mi samcha, who are you to tell us and Jews worldwide that Rashi has to be that? So there were even attempts, it sounds like, we don't have this anywhere in Ashkenazic literature, but we have these complaints about Northern French scholars that they were trying to impose Rashi. So there's not too many texts about which you can say that that this is the case, and Peirush Rashi al Torah is one of them.
But what's interesting is you do point out that something that it's kind of lacking in canonization wise is that there's no one set Rashi, so to speak, and also there's no Tzuras HaDaf, there's no one exact page layout. Every edition is different, which is an interesting aspect also, right?
Right. I mean, there's all sorts of definitions out there when scholars talk about canonical texts. And one thing they sometimes do talk about is that, the text that takes a certain fixed form. I mean, the Bavli for a long time, of course, did not have such a form, but eventually the brothers Ram published their version, which becomes, canonical in that sense. No one would ever think to change the well, I can't say no one because someone did, but most people would not think to change the Tzurat HaDaf. Rashi did not depend on that to win this canonical status. One thing I should mention here, it might be interesting to hear if I'm right about this, but as far as I know, the only medieval work, the only work by Rishon, if you want to put it that way, that actually gets paskened, if you want to put it that way, is Peirush Rashi al Torah, and this is part of this transformation that occurs in the practice of Shnayim Mikra ve'Echad Targum, right? La'olam yashlim adam parshiyot tavim mitzibur. Shnayim Mikra ve'Echad Targum. There's a whole interesting story there, but the odd is that we know first in the Torah, based on a lead that he presumably got from his father, the Rosh, and then in the Shulchan Aruch itself, you actually have Rashi as a possible tachlif for Targum, or even as the preferred way to fulfill that particular private practice of going over the Parsha. So that's a pretty remarkable achievement that when your sefer actually gets to be an object of psak halacha, even though you're post-rabbinic by 600 years.
Right. What's interesting here is that it's a Gemara that says Shnayim Mikra Ve'Echad Targum. So they're saying you can change the Gemara to Rashi, which is really fascinating.
Right, it's unexpected. Although there is a, as I say, a sort of history, a regular chad. People, there was a problem here. We know that there were two institutions involving Aramaic. One was the Meturgaman, and the other, which was of course a public institution, in the sense it was done in the Beit Knesset, and the other was Shnayim Mikra. The Meturgaman goes out of fashion pretty early. The Shulchan Aruch, I think, already even says, because we don't understand Aramaic anymore. So, and he says ma toelet. What do we gain by speaking a language we don't understand? You might have thought the same thing would happen to Shnayim Mikra ve'Echad Targum, but that does not happen. But you do have a problem. It would be like telling people in Lakewood, every week, read the Parsha twice in Hebrew, once in Italian. Well, they might ask you at a certain point, why am I reading Italian? I understand Italian. If you tell them twice in Hebrew and once in English, okay, there's a svara there, right? People don't have mastery of the Hebrew. And that's what Aramaic, of course, was, the lingua franca of Jews, among others. But as Aramaic becomes obsolete, especially after the Muslim invasions, most of the Jewish world now is living in an Arabophone world where they speak Arabic, and Aramaic becomes less accessible. So this becomes an issue. And then the question is what to do. We do have some evidence that people turn to vernacular translation, the equivalent of the Stone Chumash, let's call it, in different times and places. But not all Rabbanim were happy with that because they didn't necessarily know who's producing these translations and how reliable are they. And so it was the Smag who has this idea. So time, I don't know, like what, 150 years after Rashi, mid 13th century anyway. People want to look it up. It's in Mitzvah to say Yud Tet. He says Danti, something Danti Bifnei Rabotai or something like that. He had this idea. Well, maybe we have a solution to this problem. We should do Shnayim Mikra ve'Echad Peirush. Ha Peirush, I think he says, with Hey Yediyah. He doesn't have to tell you what it is. I mean, there's no competition to speak of at that point, certainly not in northern France. Ha Peirush is Peirush Rashi. And there's various reasons that could be given for why that is. Rashi, of course, first of all, does bring the Targum fairly frequently, so that might have seemed like a natural segue from Targum to Rashi. Some people say Targum is, sort of a rabbinic work. It has the sort of feeling of Chazal. Based approach to things. So Rashi also, of course, doesn't speak so much in his name and speaks mostly in the name of Chazal. But whatever the reasons are, there's various reasons that are given over the age. I think the Magen Avraham says it's Banui al Talmud. At any rate, the Smug has this idea, and not everyone rushed to accept it for the reason you suggest. I mean, here you have a favorite Gemara. And Lichora, we can't just go, maybe you can add Rashi, but who's to say you can jettison the Targum? That wasn't so obvious. I think I surmise in the book, I don't have that much proof and I don't look into it a ton, but it got accepted more in France in part because, you know, that was Rashi's home turf. We know certain people in Germany, like the Truma Tedeschen and Rav Yisrael Iserlein, they still paskin that you had to do the Targum, but already they are reading Rashi, and we even have his Ha'arot on Rashi, which becomes a sort of Peirush on Rashi. So over time, you know, that did become a default of many. So that, you know, in terms of canonization, you know, making it into the Torah and the Shulchan Aruch is a pretty good way to do it.
For sure. So the next part of your book, which is, I guess, the main part of your book, discusses criticism of Rashi, which is obviously at the margin, something that's not known really, like you said, till today. Why is that something that you decided to look into? And how did you actually find these Sfarim and start researching this?
Well, I do have a noble aspiration to, or a Yetzer Hara for, not sure which, bringing alternate voices to the table and, allowing names that don't always get a hearing to have their say. I was quoting at Shabbat yesterday something from Reb Avraham Saba's Peirush HaOt HaRa. Some of my kids looked at me a little quizzically and asked, who's he and why are we talking about it? Right? So, this is a man who, suffered two expulsions and had to start a sefer, from the beginning because he lost it. Let's learn a little of his Torah. So I guess I felt something of a yen to do that with these particular figures as well. And as I say, the sort of issue of Midrash was something that always compelled me, and these people were particularly not just critical of Midrash, but openly critical of Midrash in terms that were surprisingly sharp. So that was at least some of what drew me to the criticism. I guess I should say that I don't think it's so straightforward to argue that it's only marginal figures who are critical of Rashi, because we do have already Ibn Ezra, who flees Muslim Spain, ends up in Christian Europe, and Pitom, he realizes that there's this fellow Rabbeinu Shlomo, and people think pretty highly of him. In one of his grammatical works, Sefer Biruah, he has a passage which often gets quoted where he talks about how Chazal definitely privileged Pshat, new Pshat. Drashi says it's Tosefet Tam. But he says, a catastrophe happened and the later generations didn't understand the hierarchy over here. And as a result, they think that Drush is the Ikar. And if you ask, where this is most evidently manifest, so it's manifest in Peirushei Rashi. And he has the biting line there that even though Rashi said that he came to reveal the contextual or simple meaning of the Ketuvim, Pshuto Shel Mikra, he succeeded in doing that only Echad Mini Elef. So that was sort of a kickoff for Spanish criticism of Rashi. But I would say, anyone who reads Peirush Ranban of Torah knows that as respectful as he typically is, doesn't tend to say anything too harsh, certainly nothing like he says about Ibn Ezra. But one of my other Harvard teachers, Beryl Septimus, in an article makes the point that even though he's more fiercely and openly critical of Ibn Ezra, it's restricted to certain specific issues, whereas his criticism of Rashi in many ways is a more sustained criticism. Sometimes he'll explain Rashi, but often there'll be that, Va'al derech ha'pshat. And at that point, that minimally Ranban wants us to know that what Rashi gives us as seemingly his Pshuto Shel Mikra is certainly not Pshuto Shel Mikra. The drash it may be, and maybe a worthy drash at that. But it's important for Ranban that we understand the distinction. So, there are more famous critics, but they're more mild critics. You're right that the critics that I focus on in the book are three in number, and they are quite openly, and sometimes I would even say shockingly, critical of Rashi. So one was someone named Elazar Ashkenazi ben Natan HaBavli, and he wrote a Peirush on the Torah called Safnat Paneach. It wasn't primarily directed at Rashi, but he does mention Rashi in places and often has some choice words for Rashi. And again, when you're criticizing Rashi, as often as not, you're criticizing Divrei Chazal. So that's one of the critics, and I can tell you a bit about the story of that sefer and how it got into my hands. An interesting story unto itself. The second person, we don't know who he was. I worked hard to identify him, didn't quite manage, though I think I can identify the region in which he wrote. And he wrote this sefer Hasagot under the name of Rabat or the Ravid. And that is the only work that I know which was written with the sole intent of criticizing Peirush Rashi, all the Torah. And the third author was someone named Aaron Abulrabi, who wrote a work which is sort of a hybrid. He actually has Peirushim of his own, but a lot of times he focuses on Rashi. There at the, in his Hakdamah, he says, again, reminding us why Rashi was so pivotal and why he made a claim on people. He says, any other parshan is a dat yechid. So, I can like their Peirush, I cannot like their Peirush, but, it doesn't impose anything on me. Whereas Rashi, he says, is Chazal, Eshrei Rav Reve, he says, Rashi doesn't speak in his own name, but he speaks in the name of Chazal. So at that point, I feel compelled to engage with Rashi because he is the spokesperson for rabbinic tradition. So those are the three critics. Each has a bit of their own profile. What I tried to do was catalog ways in which they were spurred to criticism, and sort of the larger conceptual framework there was people who came with, I would say, I like to put it this way, a tale of two Judaisms. There's Rashi's Judaism, which is of a certain sort, and these were people who had different heroes than Rashi. Their heroes were Ibn Ezra and, of course, the Rambam, Nesher HaGadol, and so they perceive in some cases Rashi as a threat to the future of Judaism, because if you have a Maimonidean view of Judaism, then you're probably not going to feel that Rashi has much to contribute. That would be the polite way to put it. But you might also think that to the extent that people are reading Rashi, they're going to end up with misapprehensions about what really counts and what counts as the Shlemut HaAdam and all sorts of other issues. So the larger framework for that section was a sort of battle in the Jewish public square, at least so I like to put it somewhat dramatically, over the future of Judaism. And not to to have too many spoilers, but to a large extent, the book concludes Rashi won.
Right. Do want to jump back for a second, Brother Beth Ibn Ezra. So Masada Rukh just published now a brand new edition of Sefer Brura. I have not seen it. I'm curious what they did with that passage. Are there any notes? I want to actually see what they did there because it's kind of obviously sharp criticism of Rashi, so to speak. So.
Well, that's interesting. I haven't seen that, so have to check Sepharim Chatter more often to find out what's happening.
Yeah, just came out now on the sale. Yeah, just now. In regards to so I should mention also, you didn't mention there that this Hasagas Haraiva, which you called Pseudo Rabad, you actually published a critical edition of that, right?
Right, that's in the maybe the second to last Kovetz al-Yad. It's there with for everybody to read and either to put in cherem or to take inspiration from as they see fit.
Right. Now the other one, Elazar Ashkenazi in his Sofnas Paneach. So he's not really Yezer Ashkenazi from Ma'aseh Hashem for everybody. Elazar, a different person, but
Correct.
as well, there is some version of it on Hebrew books, but most of it is not in print. It's a manuscript, and you want to tell over the story, which is pretty fascinating that you mentioned in the book, I believe, as well.
Yeah, it's first of all, the loan copy which came down was produced in Crete in 1399. Crete happens to be an interesting place for these things because there were Sephardim there were Ashkenazim there were native, they call them Romaniote Jews, the Eastern Byzantine Jews. So it was a real sort of Jewish cultural melting pot with all that that can imply about sort of like having, I don't know, YU next to Lubavitch and Slobodka. You would expect it to be lively over there. So Crete is sort of a it's also geographically a crossing point for people traveling the Mediterranean. So that's where it was produced. It eventually made its way to Avram Epstein, who was a bibliophile in Vienna. And he gave it to the community of the community library of the Jewish community in Vienna. With the advent of the Nazis in Vienna, of course, they confiscated all sorts of Jewish books, all sorts of Jewish artifacts, with the intention of producing a museum to the people they hope to eradicate. Thank God that was not successful. And the end of the war saw the Red Army arrive and intercept the train load of these Jewish artifacts as they were being taken back, I think, to Berlin. I don't know all the details of the story. The upshot being that this work, among many works, including a lot of Lubavitch writings, which were the subject of a court case, I think it was some 20 years ago in New York, about which I can't tell you too many details, but a lot of writings of Sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe, I think, even ended up in the Russian state military archives in Moscow. And for some 6 decades, no one knew about this. It was a secret closed archive. With the opening of the Soviet Union, whenever it was, the 80s, the 90s, glasnost, perestroika, and etc. So there was huge awareness of the number of valuable Hebrew manuscripts that were unfortunately not, handsomely cataloged in some university library where you could just show up with your faculty card and look at them. But they're essentially the property of the Russian army. I don't know how many Russian soldiers are reading, 14th century Pei Regime Alatorah. I don't think too many. So we have the situation like we often have, where things that really are the patrimony of the Jewish people ended up waylaid in either the Vatican or, in this case, in the Russian state military archives. So I don't have much of a social life, and I was once flipping through a catalog of Hebrew holdings in Russian libraries, and I stumbled on this work, which, as you say, has been very partially published in the 60s by someone named Shlomo Rappaport, about whom I can't tell you very much. He had taken out photostats of, I don't know, it was like 30 folio pages. The whole manuscript is quite huge, it's like 130 folio pages. So it was a small number. I think it was through Parsha, then just about through the end of Parsha Vayera and the Akedah. So that was published, and as you say, you had reminded me, I'd forgotten that if I ever knew it. It's available on Hebrew Books. But there were certain ways he published it that made it hard to understand exactly. He had excerpts at the back, and it wasn't clear exactly where they came from and how they fit with the regular Perush. At any rate, I discovered that this copy, which had been thought presumably lost, was actually in Russia. Then the question became how to get it out. That's a long story where I won't tell you all the details. I can tell you that the final moment was when I met somebody at the Islamic Museum in Jerusalem to pay for this. One did have to pay a pretty penny to get all the, of course, I don't have the original manuscript, but needless to say, remains in Moscow. But what I did get was a digital copy. So, we have a chance again to rescue a lost voice from the Jewish past, which we thought would perhaps never be recovered. And that's something that I'm working on currently as part of my current project. But it's quite a hefty tome, and has a lot of original touches. So there's a lot of work to be done before I'm able to say much. But I did publish one article in Hebrew, but that was before I really had my hands on the whole document. So it's a case where I can actually test my previous conclusions and see if I was right or wrong about Rashi and a lot of other things based on that small published part that I was working from originally.
Right. Is it something you'd look to publish as a sefer or excerpts, like in little parts of it in the Kevitz Eliyahu or something, or you're not sure yet?
I would love to publish it as a sefer. My current project is actually on Perushim from Byzantium. There's a whole world of Perushim, but they have the characteristic of being extremely long in many cases. And I do have a bit of a research team helping me. I have a research grant to do some of the work, but as you know, it's an arduous process. And so the question becomes how to prioritize publishing the text versus analyzing the text. I don't think I will quickly be able to publish all of these mammoth commentaries. What I will try to do is publish representative excerpts, I think, which will give people a taste of some of the multidimensional character of these very interesting and pretty much unknown Perushim from the Eastern Mediterranean. We tend to think of Sfarad, we tend to think of Ashkenaz, maybe of Italia. Somehow the stepchild, at least in academic Jewish studies, but I think it's true to some extent in general, of great Jewish medieval literature is Byzantium. So it's awaiting its goel, and I'm going to try to do my humble part to do some of that.
Right. Okay. And as we finish up slowly here, the final one that you really focused on is Aharon Abu-Rabi, as you said, and he's interesting is that that sefer was actually published with a couple of other svarim, despite the criticism, which is pretty interesting. So maybe talk a little bit about that sefer.
Yeah, that was published once in Constantinople, we think in 1525, based on the type of printing that appears in the text. It's very hard to read text. It's also a very rare text. Many of the Constantinople printings are rare editions. So it was published. This is just located in time for people who, want a point of reference. This is the time when the Mizrahi is the, officially the chief rabbi of Ottoman Jewry. And living in Constantinople, the Mizrahi finished his Peirush on Rashi, didn't quite finish it, but came pretty close to finishing it. Around 1526, he goes to the Yeshiva Shalmala, as his son Yisrael puts it, and his son takes it to Venice to be printed. A couple of years before that, this volume appears called Peirushim on Rashi Zal, and it contains four Peirushim on Rashi of Sephardic commentators on Rashi, which again tells us something of a story that Rashi, the great Ashkenazi Parshan, became so popular in Spain is is something that I try and talk about in the book and what the attraction was, but it certainly wasn't something one could assume was inevitable. Let's put it that way. Now we're in Constantinople or Istanbul by now because it's been conquered by the Muslims in 1453. And we have a publisher who puts out this volume. He was getting these Peirushim as he was publishing them. The Abu Rabi actually starts, I think, on, a daf Yud Gimel or something like that. And he says, "Oh, well, someone just brought me another Peirush, and they asked me to publish it. And because the Chevrat HaChachamim were really into this Abu Rabi, so I decided I was going to add it." So he was a Sicilian scholar. He wandered around the Mediterranean. He was a bit of a feisty fellow, as best one can tell. He talks about arguments he had with Karaites. He talks about arguments he had with Christians. And he was, also pretty feisty when it came to Rashi himself, although he often is sympathetic to Rashi and Chazal in a way that some of these other critics aren't. I try to talk about some of the things that he appreciated about Rashi. At any rate, he makes it into this volume. And I think, one of the interesting things is it tells you there was a real market for Peirushim on Rashi. People generally publish things among other reasons, maybe for noble reasons, but also to make a buck, or I don't know what the currency was in Constantinople. At any rate, the publisher publishes these four Peirushim on Rashi, and it seems that there was real interest in Rashi. And that's a story that I've told a little bit, but there's much more to say. We're all familiar with some of these Svarim, Sifti Chachamim, Gur Aryeh, Levush Orah. I mean, a whole panoply of Peirushim on Rashi, Divrei David, especially in Ashkenaz. Gedolei Ashkenaz really stop writing Peirushim on the Torah, certain exceptions like Kli Yakar, and they express themselves through Peirushim on Rashi. So the question is why and what comes of that, and that's that's something I hope people will be attracted to more than they have been up until now, certainly in the scholarly world, and use these wonderful texts and tell us what they can teach us about not just about Rashi, of course, but about what the Torah meant to them and what it should mean to us.
Right. Okay. I guess the last question I'll end off is what are you working on? So what are you working on now that you're finished with Rashi? You're still with Rashi or you move on to a different project?
I've kept up things with Rashi. I wrote an article on the question of Stirot and Peirush Rashi Ala Torah. The Mizrahi actually is the one who came to the conclusion, not necessarily because he wanted to, but there doesn't seem to be too worked up about it, that Rashi sometimes contradicts himself. You can have an Agadah or a Midrash in one place in the Peirush which contradicts another Midrash. He actually says this in his first comments on Peirush Rashi, because Rashi begins by talking about why we begin with Bereishit, should have been with Chodesh HaZeh Lachem. And he says it's because we have a claim on Eretz Yisrael, and the Umot might say Listimatem. But then later on, Rashi tells us that Malchitzedek is actually Shem ben Noach. So after the Mabul, Eretz Yisrael was bequeathed to the wine of Shem, and that's the wine of Abraham. So why do we need all of Sefer Bereishit to tell us about that? We already have our pedigree from our claim on Eretz Yisrael from Shem ben Noach. So Mizrahi gives that as an example of what he calls Agadot Chalukot. And so that's something that not everyone accepted. Let's say Besefer Panim Yafot. Actually, you mentioned Maaseh Hashem. He's one of the people who's very unhappy with this theory of Mizrahi. He says it can't be that Rashi, who comes, to teach us what the meaning of the Torah, would contradict themselves. And he says it comes out then that it's not just Rashi who contradicts himself, but the Psukim themselves contradict themselves. He says something to the effect that this is something that a maskil, lo yikabel data maskil, something along those lines. But my main project now is on these Byzantine commentators. Again, they're not necessarily well-known names. One is Elazar Ashkenazi, but there are others. A text that I'm working on at the moment is it's called Minchat Knaot. I don't think that's the name the author gave it, but it's written by someone named Zachariah ben Moshe, again in Crete. And it has a it's a sort of its defense of Ibn Ezra and Rambam against attacks of Ramban in his Perush al Torah. So you have an interesting, again, dynamic there, where just as the Mizrahi defends Rashi for Ramban, so here you have someone defending Ibn Ezra and Maimonides from Ramban, but he also goes on the offensive. And there too you have what you can call hasagot, a sort of interesting thing that some Jews to invest time and energy writing these hasagot. So these are effectively hasagot on Ramban, and that's a text that has been published but hasn't really been analyzed that much. So that's one of the texts as part of this new project.
Gotcha. Fascinating. Okay. Thank you very much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Okay, real pleasure, and enjoy the show, and b'hatzlacha.
Thank God. You all.
Bye.